Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Elizabeth Gelman, Executive Director of the Florida Holocaust Museum, speaking about the shocking issue of the desecration of Jewish gravestones going on now in Europe. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and Leah Avuno, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the Sunday of the Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, and at a time when we are again struggling with issues of racial equality in America, it's important to remember the moment of history in which Dr. King came to prominence in the 1950s and early 1960s. At that time, much of America was segregated. The South was famously racist. It was a time when the concept of a black American president was impossible to imagine. Remember that when President Barack Obama was born in 1961, the year I was born, there were Jim Crow facilities all through the American South, and most blacks could not vote. There were segregated bathrooms, segregated restaurants, segregated buses, and so on. And separate, by no means meant equal, schools throughout the North, that's the North, folks, were also segregated, although perhaps slightly less obviously so. But still, blacks and whites, in effect, attended different educational institutions of very different quality. In large parts of America then, African Americans had to sit in the back of the bus, drink from separate water fountains, use outside toilets, eat in different restaurants, stay in inferior hotels, couldn't use public pools. In 1968, when President Obama was 7 years old, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by a white racist, precipitating race riots throughout the country. I remember it well. I was 7 years old. Changes occurred because of the civil rights movement, because of the courage of the marchers at Selma, Alabama, and throughout the South, and the support of a free press and principled white and black activists who sometimes paid with their lives. Things began to change immediately, but it took a long time for real transformation to take place. Many whites, and in particular many Jews, marched with Dr. King, inspired by words of his when he wrote, "When Moses walked into the courts of Pharaoh and thundered forth with the call to let my people go, he introduced into history the concept of a God who was concerned about the freedom and dignity of all his children, active in the affairs of men, struggling relentlessly against the forces of evil that beset them, seeking to mold a people who will serve as his children, as partners in the building of his kingdom here on earth." Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel famously wrote in a letter to Dr. King after marching with him in Selma, "Even without words, our march was worship. I felt like my legs were praying." King understood that racism against one minority is racism against all minorities, that vicious, bigoted hatred must be resisted solely because it is wrong. And King said so.
"My Jewish brothers and sisters said to me amid anti-Semitism anywhere that we don't need your support. We have enough Jewish power to deal with this problem ourselves. I would still take a stand against anti-Semitism because it's wrong, it's unjust, and it's evil. If my Catholic brothers and sisters said to me, amid bigotry toward Catholics, we don't need your support in this because we have enough Catholic power to deal with it, I would still take a stand against bigotry toward Catholics because it is wrong, it is evil, and it is unjust."
You know, we Americans are strange about race to this day. We're in the last days of the presidency of a black man of these same United States. He was elected twice in a row to the highest office in the land, the most powerful position in the world. That is the kind of fact that proves America can indeed be the land of opportunity. But this is also the land in which the next president, the incoming one, Donald Trump, spent years pretending Obama was born in another country, falsely claiming he wasn't a real American, and many other Americans somehow believed this claptrap. Racism comes in many forms. And in the election campaign last year, and in the months between Trump's election and his inauguration this coming week, there's been a significant uptick in racist incidents throughout our country. It is our land of opportunity that is also the country of Ferguson, Missouri, 2 years ago, of Freddie Gray's death in Baltimore and the subsequent riots last spring and summer, of a Chicago guy, Laquan McDonald, shot 16 times by a policeman, 9 times in the back, and that officer was charged with murder, of Dylan Roof's racist rampage at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, of the killing of Walter Scott in North Charleston in 2015, of notorious incidents of shootings of unarmed black men in 2016 in, among other places, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Police officer there has been charged with homicide, of Michael Brown's killing, of Eric Garner killed in an illegal police chokehold when he was arrested in New York for selling cigarettes. We remain the country of Trayvon Martin, killed with Skittles in his hand. We are a nation in which young black men are way more likely to get killed by police than those of any other race. Oh, except for Native Americans. Statistics never tell the whole story. Still, if you are an African-American male between the ages of 15 and 19, there is a more than 20 times greater chance you will be killed by police than if you are white. As the father of two young men in that age range, this is a jarring statistic. While in general, violent crime in America has fallen steadily since 1990, nobody really knows why, it is still stunning and depressing that it's not true for everyone. There's also an exception to this drop in homicides in the city of Chicago, where the murder rate is spiking horribly. Perhaps because of lax gun laws and a hostile climate between police and the population, and a wild increase in gang violence. The increased victims, of course, are mostly young black males. And that is just for young black men. Many of the most recent incidents around the country involved unarmed African Americans who were 40 or 50 years old. You know, according to the Torah, each and every human being is created in the image of God, B'Tselem Elohim, must be evaluated on the quality of his or her character, as Dr. King said, not the color of his skin. We are all equally sacred to God, no matter what we look like. And while we have made enormous progress since the days of Selma and of Mississippi burning, we still have a long way to go before we achieve the dream of a truly colorblind society in America. I hope we are not suddenly going again the wrong way. May this weekend help us instead reach towards that goal, because we have serious work to do here. To play us in on this King weekend morning, here's a setting of a beautiful passage from the Talmud, Laman Achai Verei, because of my brothers, sisters, and friends, from the house of God I say peace to you. Laman Achai, in a setting by Yitzchak Rosenthal of Shalsheles, sung with the a cappella group, the Maccabees. That was Laman Achai V'Rei'i, sung by the a cappella groups Shalshelis and the Maccabees. Because of my brothers, sisters, and friends, I say peace to you of all races and backgrounds. This is the house of God. I seek the best for you. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Elizabeth Gelman, is the executive director of the Florida Holocaust Museum. She has a powerful and painful story to tell about the ongoing desecration of Jewish gravestones in Europe. It's happening right now, and we'll hear that shocking story and about a fascinating exhibit about it when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Elizabeth Gelman is head of the Florida Holocaust Museum, which has a fascinating exhibit dealing with a really traumatic and difficult subject, the reuse of Jewish gravestones in Europe. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about how this exhibit at your museum developed.
Well, you know, it's fascinating, always fascinating. Someone had read an article in the Tablet, and that someone ended up being just showing it to me at an event that we were at, and the two of us started to delve in this together. And the more we looked into what had happened there, and this photographer, Lucas Baksik, we were really intrigued, not only at what he had done photographing this kind of horrific reuse of matzavot, but his story himself.
And the photographer's work is not, you know, this isn't Roman Vishniak. This isn't something that he took photos of 50, 60, 80 years ago. This is contemporary.
That's correct. So he photographed about 300 repurposed matzavot. This is not his profession, but it was a real calling for him. And he traveled, I think, over 20,000 miles throughout Poland, taking pictures of repurposed matzavot.
What are some of the examples of the uses of these matzavot?
They have been, there's still many of them, are parts of fences, pavements, a grindstone. You can see them on swimming pools, sometimes on the side of swimming pools. There are paths that lead in the forest, and they are just used in different farms to, to repair the gates and cow sheds and anything that needed repair. These gravestones were used.
It would be kind of useful to think that people didn't realize what they were doing, but they actually obviously know what these are, correct?
Well, I would say that at the beginning, people knew what they were. Certainly that seemed to be intentional. The Nazis came in, they began this. And after the Nazis left, the neighbors, the people who were still there, the Poles, continued this reuse. I would say what's the most interesting to me is that it's continued through the 1990s, and the majority of people who took them didn't really understand what they were. I mean, they knew they were gravestones, but they didn't really understand, you know, who the Jews were. They didn't grow up with Jews.
We will continue to discuss this interesting and very disturbing subject of the repurposing of Jewish gravestones in Europe and the display at the Florida Holocaust Museum when we return in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Rabbi.
Quitting smoking, big part of your lives.
Yeah, it's very important. When we started this company just over 6 years ago, it was because I had a really bad cigar habit, and it was time for me to quit. We have 7 children. Our youngest just turned 8, and I wish to be around to watch them all grow up and have successful careers and family of their own.
And Pamela, it's better personally, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a non-smoker, and being with a person who smokes cigars in particular, it's much nicer. It doesn't, his body doesn't reek of it, his hair does not reek of it, his clothes do not smell of it, and there's no tobacco between his teeth anymore.
And you don't have to send him for extra showers or out in the rain.
No extra showers.
How can people find out more about Freedom Smoke?
You can look us up on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-705-7013. That's 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rabbi.
You.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website by streaming them or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome a randomly recurring feature of Too Jewish, Zen Judaism. In nature, there is no good or bad, better or worse. The wind may blow or not. The flowering branch grows long or short. Do not judge. Do not prefer. Ask only, is it good for the Jews? That was a koan from the eternal wisdom of Zen Judaism. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And I didn't get a chance to say this to you personally. Happy secular New Year. Happy Sylvester a couple weeks ago. The UN resolution that the United States did not veto, this is the last days of the Obama administration we're in now, the response in America and the American Jewish community was very strong. What was the response like in Israel? You were there.
I think that this time, I was in Israel when the resolution passed in the UN, we were mainly shocked by the way, you know, we used to get the American, you know, kind of protection, and we were shocked by not having America using her veto power, because it's not the first resolution against Israel. Only in the past 2 years we had 20 against us, so it's not the 20.
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
20.
Yeah, right.
But
there have been, I don't know, hundreds, a couple of hundred.
Yeah,
anti-Israel,
I'm talking only about
resolutions.
The last 2 years, 15 and 16.
Right,
there were 20. I just
resolutions.
Checked.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But so it's not the single resolution. It's as we talked before, it's more the trend. And I think by not using the veto power, we saw the trend of not supporting as an ally, not supporting Israel as an real ally. That's what I felt in Israel. That's what I felt around me. That's what I heard in the news in Israel. That was the shock.
In addition to the shock that the United States didn't veto this resolution as we vetoed so many others,
And preventing so many others even to come to the floor.
And preventing others from even coming to the table. You know, Egypt was going to propose this resolution. They were talked out of it. Then it was proposed the next day anyway. There was obviously a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff going on. Does this really impact Israelis in a practical sense, or is it more of a symbolic and spiritual front?
I think, first of all, it's a symbolic and, you know, really, I don't want to say, like, kind of being abandoned.
Yeah.
And I feel we feel the same after the Iranian agreement. It's the same feeling of being abandoned by a big brother or by a big supporter, which all the above are true. But in terms of being, you know, big brother and big supporter,
right,
and ally,
I mean,
and friend and everything.
Right, I mean, the Iran nuclear deal, far more important practical implications than
yeah.
this.
And again, it was more the feeling of being abandoned by America. We never felt abandoned by Iran or Iraq.
No. But you have to have someone on your side before they can abandon you.
Exactly. I think we get used to, from our first days of Israel, to have Israel next to us, to have America next to us. And this was not the first time, but that's why I'm talking more about a trend and not just a singular.
And we can continue this next week. Thanks,
yes.
Oshrat.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We'll talk then.
Thank you.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or, Rabbi.
It's the Martin Luther King weekend. It's an important weekend
yeah.
in America. Big focus on social justice, social action. A complicated question this year. It's always a complicated question in America. Different question for you. Mm-hmm. In a Jewish day school environment, you have students who are from Reform Jewish families in which social action, social justice is really central to their Jewish identity. You have students from conservative families where that may be a part, it may
mm-hmm.
not.
Mm-hmm.
You have students from Orthodox families where there's a great focus on helping other Jews, but maybe not the same focus on social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have kids from a more secular background. It's a really interesting
right.
mix.
Right.
How do you teach about social justice in that environment?
It's a great question. And you know, it's a question that connects to a lot of the approach of a community Jewish day school, which is what we are at THA. There are different kinds of day school programs throughout the nation internationally. But our model is a community school where all types of Jewish families are welcome and included. So what we do is we look to our core values and our mission. What are we all about as Tucson's community Jewish day school? And so one of our core values is Tikkun Olam. It's that large concept of making the world a better place. Social justice fits beautifully under that umbrella, as does a lot of different kinds of reaching out, whether or not it's for our community or the community at large.
When you teach about social justice, you always connect it to Jewish themes, I assume. Plenty of them there. And
sure.
certainly the various social justice movements in America have often taken biblical texts and Jewish
sure.
texts.
Sure.
What do you think is the most important value to be teaching right now in 2017, in January of 2017, around the King weekend?
Great question. You know, I think we need to be remembering how to listen to each other and how to dialogue. It seems like the what we've experienced in the last several months has been this very high level of intensity of an upset dialogue. And that can play out in relationships in a professional environment or in a personal environment. And so I think, you know, it's a nice opportunity for us to kind of back up and say, how do we have conversations? What's the appropriate way to be a listener? When do we comment? And you know, if we're disagreeing, what are some ways to have a disagreement? As a people, we are famous arguers and debaters. and, you know, we're very armed with knowledge and information and certainly opinions. And it's important that we talk about them and share them and that we do so in a way that's productive, that's positive, that keeps kind of things together and moving forward in a good way.
So if we can begin to hear each other, do a little bit of shema, really listening, then maybe we can work together to solve the problems in society.
Right. We're all in this together. And how can we work together to make it better?
From your mouth to God's ears. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Shavua Tov.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you, while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. David received a parrot for his birthday. The parrot was fully grown, but it had a bad attitude and a worse vocabulary. Every other word was a curse word. Those that weren't were, well, at the least, rude. David tried hard to change the bird's attitude. He was constantly saying polite things to it, playing soft Israeli dance music, anything. But none of it worked. He yelled at the bird, but the bird got worse. David shook the bird, and the bird got madder and ruder and bluer in its language. Finally, in a moment of desperation, David stuck the parrot in the freezer. For a few moments, he heard the bird squawk, kick, curse, and scream, and then suddenly, it went quiet. David was worried he might have actually hurt the bird, and he quickly opened the freezer. The parrot calmly stepped out onto David's extended arm and said, "Sir, I'm sorry if I offended you with my language and actions. I ask for your forgiveness humbly. I will go to synagogue with you every week and pray and endeavor to modify my behavior to suit your own preferences." David was astounded at the bird's change in attitude. He said, "Great!" He was about to put the parrot back in its cage when the bird suddenly asked, "May I ask, sir, what did the chicken do to offend you?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, second book of the Torah, with the great Torah portion of Shmot. I admit to being a little bit biased here. This was my own bar mitzvah Torah portion. But still, Shmot must be one of the greatest sections of the Torah of all. It begins with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereshit, made up of Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph is the effective ruler of the country. They settle in Goshen in the north and flourish there. And then the fateful events that set the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph and his contributions. The Israelites are now viewed very differently. As they grow in number and wealth, the new pharaoh worries. The immigrants might serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language. They worship a different god. Their hair must be curlier, their noses larger, their skin a little darker, perhaps. Certainly they have funny accents. They must be trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, store cities, for the royal government. They set up overseers, taskmasters, established work quotas, pushed them harder and harder, try to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews are tougher than the Egyptians expect, and not the last time that happened, they decide to simply kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, later to be the priestly tribe, a woman hides her newborn boy baby till his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him in a tiny ark, a new Noah, and sets him a sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is about to begin. Shmot tells us of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai. It shows him mature, marry, father children in the desert. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that brings him back into the crucible of history and leads him to become the greatest liberator the world has ever known. Finally, Shmot returns him to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There's almost too much in this Torah portion to grasp, encapsulating it as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. Most importantly, unlike so many other traditions' hero stories, Exodus does not make Moses a god or even into a perfect paragon. He's just a man, a great, flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to that greatness only through trial and error, learning how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. Shmot, all of Exodus, really is a great story, of course, but more than that, it's an incredible lesson. Moses became the model for every truly great leader thereafter because of his very humanity, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, to utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish everything. May we come to understand that we can accomplish great things too, if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations, so long as we fight for justice, freedom, and truth. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Elizabeth Gelman, the executive director of the Florida Holocaust Museum, will tell us about the shocking desecration of Jewish gravestones going on now in Europe and a remarkable exhibit about it. Find out about it and what you might be able to do to help when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
By a bipartisan vote of 342-80, the United States House of Representatives has condemned the recent resolution of the United Nations, which called upon Israel to not only cease construction of settlements in areas which it captured in 1967, but was also critical of any Jewish presence in East Jerusalem. Congress characterized the resolution as a one-sided effort, which was an obstacle to peace, placing disproportionate blame on Israel and discouraging Palestinians from engaging in direct bilateral relations. It also noted that in the way the UN statement was written, if enforced, would prevent Jews from worshiping at the Western Wall, located in East Jerusalem, while at the same time making no mention of Palestinian terrorism. In the wake of the presidential election, some 200 American Jewish historians have written an open letter, which appeared in the Los Angeles Jewish Times, calling upon American Jews, mindful of past persecution and discrimination of the Jewish people, to stand up, not only against anti-Semitism, but all other forms of hatred, which have increased since Election Day. The letter calls attention to statements issued by the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which emphasized that the Holocaust did not begin with killing, but with words. It also cites the comments of the president of the Center for Jewish History in New York City, who declared, quotes, "We must unequivocally protest against violence or discrimination motivated by ethnicity, religion, or sexual identity." And just this week, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are in close contact with Jewish community centers throughout the country, describing ways and means of bolstering security after 16 of these centers received bomb threats on the very same day. Facebook, which has come under fire for its distribution of what were false news accounts, has announced that it has hired former CNN and NBC anchor Campbell Brown, who was Jewish, as its coordinator for news dissemination, in the hope of creating better ties with news agencies and preventing the distribution of false statements and outright lies posing as truth, a matter which has become a serious problem for the mass media. During its recent convention in Philadelphia, the Modern Language Association, the largest scholarly body in the United States, rejected a proposal to boycott Israel academics. In rejecting the proposal, the organization declared, approval of a boycott was not only racist and anti-Semitic, but smacked of McCarthyism as well. And in a revolutionary first, conversions to Judaism and instruction and preparation for doing so are now being undertaken over the Internet. A case in point is the conversion of 82-year-old Diana Sewell, a woman living in a small Australian town with no rabbi and very few Jews, who said that becoming Jewish fulfilled a lifelong dream. Mrs. Sewell's teacher was a rabbi in Brunswick, Georgia, and her conversion ceremony was performed, again, over the Internet, involving additional rabbis from other cities in the United States. The procedure has met with both support and some criticism. While acknowledging its benefits, especially for persons living in isolated places anywhere in the world, its shortcomings are best summarized by Professor Sylvia Fishman of Brandeis University. "I don't think it's possible," said she, "to come to an understanding of a person and why they want to do this and how they envision their lives afterward unless you actually spend real time with them." And that's the Two Jewish News.
We welcome back our guest this morning on Two Jewish. Elizabeth Gelman is the director of the Florida Holocaust Museum, which is on the west coast of Florida, actually, as opposed to the east coast. They have a fascinating display and a very disturbing one about the repurposing of Matzevot, the reuse of Jewish gravestones all over Europe for a variety of purposes, and a display by a remarkable, I guess, amateur photographer is the right way to put it, isn't it?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, Lucas has told us that he had spent a lot of time walking around the countryside when he came upon these the Jewish grave sites that were there, and most of them had been destroyed. And he thought that that was, you know, really fascinating, the idea that a graveyard is really the remains of a community. It is the remembrance of a community. And certainly one of Hitler's goals was to not only destroy the Jewish people, but to wipe out all memory of them. And seeing these graveyards destroyed really touched him. As he walked around the countryside, he started to find these gravestones repurposed. And it really touched him deep inside, and he began photographing them.
You know, it's fascinating the way that, for want of a better term, evil or evil uses become routine to the point where people don't even understand the damage that's being done. These gravestones, many of which go back even hundreds of years from the pictures, being used to block up doorways or to build stone walls, even when there's plenty of other stones around, they're just considered to be stones. Is there any way that they can be restored? Are people beginning to think about ways of returning them to their proper place?
So this is a fascinating part of the exhibition and really a fascinating part of Lucas's journey. When he began his journey photographing these matzavot, he was sure he knew all the answers. He knew who the bad guys were and what needed to happen and all of that. And as he visited people who had matzavot on their property, his ideas started to change. So sometimes he would have conversations with them, and he would say, you know, do you realize that these are Jewish gravestones? And people would say no, that they didn't realize that that's what they were. And after they found out that that's what they were, they became very disturbed and wanted them to go back. And some of the stones have gone back to the cemeteries. Now, of course, because they're pieces of matzavot, most of the time they can't be put back. We don't know where they belong, whose grave they belong to. And so some of the cemeteries have created kind of a memorial wall using repurposing, once again, these repurposed matzavot into a kind of memorial to the people who were there.
It seems like that might be the most productive approach. You know, when we think about a matzeva as a permanent monument and marker, Yad Vashem, it says in Isaiah, and obviously that's the name of the Great Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. The idea of having a place to go to remember, it's fascinating that the Nazis, in a sort of horrible way, decided that they wanted to destroy the place that remembered dead Jews, which was obviously one of their great goals. What led to that? Why is there this sense that not only do you have to destroy Jewish existence, you have to destroy the fact that they were ever here when their goal was annihilation?
You know, I wish I had a simple answer for that, but the entire Nazi regime was created. It is incomprehensible, you know, to think about what they did and why they did it. All the documentation they did of their killing, and yet trying to erase each individual's name, both of those things seem to be strong, compelling points in so many places. I do think that the erasure of identity was important. Now, why that was important, you know, the Nazi ideology, I feel, is madness. So it's difficult for me to understand why they thought anything, you know, how their mind worked.
Most of his pictures seem to be from Poland. Did he go outside of Poland to photograph other places?
So no, he is Polish, and he was photographing his own land. We know that this has taken place, and he knows this has taken place in other parts of Eastern Europe, but he was just focused on Poland. Does not mean that this was the only place that it happened.
No, I'm sure. Poland has come a long way in some ways in its response to anti-Semitism. There's an extraordinary new museum in Warsaw of the Polish Jewish experience. Krakow has become a center of philo-Semitism and deep interest in Judaism, but there's also a right wing in Poland and even some sort of neo-Nazi elements. What is your perception of the likely future of these repurposed Matsevot as they currently exist in Poland?
Well, I would say that there seems to be a strong feeling that they should go back to the cemeteries. That's a majority. There are organizations within Poland itself and in other countries where people are coming to help find these repurposed Matsevot and to return them to the cemeteries. Again, those are ordinary people, and we always have to be careful not to confuse a government or a regime in any country with the ordinary citizens who may or may not be represented by that regime.
Tell me about the response to this exhibit. It's now been on since October.
Well, it's been truly embraced. There have been a lot of people coming through and a lot of students that have been using. We have a study guide that was created. For us, everything we do, we try to find a relevance to today, and this does seem to be a point where the Holocaust and current events sort of come into line. One of the big questions that Lucas asks the people who view the exhibition is, now you know about this problem, what are you going to do about that? And we feel that not only is that important in this particular area with the Matzavot, but in our own communities here in the United States. Once you know that there's a problem, what is your responsibility as an individual to right that wrong?
Where does the exhibit go from Florida?
Right now, we are in discussion with a couple of different institutions, but we don't have a particular place that it is going to in the next few months. We should know very shortly, and that will be up on our website, thefhm.org.
Right. And again, for more information about the Florida Holocaust Museum, it's fhm.org?
FHM.org.
I'm sorry. Okay. I also found it as FLHolocaustMuseum.org. That must be the old call letters, which were too long, and now they've shortened them for those of us with very small attention spans.
It's very easy to misspell the word Holocaust. That's what we found. But yes, either of those URLs will get you to our website.
Tell us just a little more about the Florida Holocaust Museum itself.
Of course. Well, we're very excited to be celebrating our 25th anniversary this year, and we were recently chosen by USA Today as the number one museum to visit in St. Petersburg, Clearwater. And that really says, I think, a lot about our visitors and the mood of the people who come down for sun and sand to beautiful St. Petersburg, who also are interested in history and also learning about the individuals who suffered and died in the Holocaust.
I want to thank Elizabeth Gelman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The exhibit is called Matsevot for Everyday Use by, and you have to pronounce Lucas's last name?
Bakshik.
So Lucas Bakshik. An extraordinary documentation of a really tragic situation. And it's good to hear that there's some effort, hopefully, to begin to create either memorials or to restore some of these gravestones to their real use. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's been a privilege.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be comedian Ilan Gold, a very funny man. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from an Israeli song for peace. It was composed by Doron Levinson, a tank commander in the Yom Kippur War, temporarily blinded, who wrote the tune. The English was written by others. It's called Lay Down Your Arms. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.